This episode contains graphic descriptions of real medical scenarios faced by real medical professionals. Listener discretion is advised. From Knowledgeable Provider, this is Critical Incident. Hey, welcome back to Knowledgeable Provider. I'm your host, Jody Marks. This Saturday, April 27th, marks 13 years since we had a huge outbreak of tornadoes in the southeast that came through our state. There were 62 tornadoes in all. Two of them were classified as EF5, which is the highest on the scale of tornado severity. In Alabama alone, there were 250 people killed on that day. I was working at HMSE at the time, and I set out on a project to interview everybody who was involved and put together a written account of everybody's stories from that day. I managed to do two interviews and then didn't do anything else with it. If you haven't already listened to the previous interview that I did about this, go back and check out episode 5 of the podcast, which is an interview with Tina Lansaw and Terry Armstrong, two paramedics who were working that day. This is the other interview I did with a paramedic named Rob Gaffin, who was working that day. At the time we did the interview, which was about a month after the storms had happened, Rob was 37 years old. He had been working in EMS for 16 years at that point. Prior to EMS, he was a truck driver. Actually became interested in EMS when he joined a police ranger program in high school and realized just from being out in the field running calls that he preferred the EMS side of things to the law enforcement side. At the time we did our interview, he was in school working on getting into pharmacy school. I believe he was finishing his bachelor's degree at the time. And he did it. He finished pharmacy school. He got his doctorate degree. He is now a pharmacist. He works with a local specialty infusion company. So good on you, Rob. Congratulations, man. I want to define some terms that Rob uses that might be helpful in listening to the episode if you're not familiar with them. 1077 is the radio code for death in the field. So he uses 1077 to refer to a couple of patients who were dead. AMS is a medical acronym that stands for altered mental status. MedCom is HMSE's communication branch or dispatch center. A linebacker is a type of radio antenna that is on top of the ambulances. C-spine refers to full spinal immobilization, which would include a C-collar, backboard, head blocks, straps. It's how you would immobilize somebody that you suspect may have a spinal injury. EJ refers to the external jugular vein. Rob mentioned starting an IV in that particular vein. He just referred to it as an EJ. VFib stands for ventricular fibrillation, which is a cardiac arrhythmia. A unit means a handheld radio, like a walkie-talkie. A lot of names of some HMSE folks show up in here. His partner that day was Matt Kingsolver. Matt's now a police officer. He mentions Tina and Terry. That's Tina Lansaw and Terry Armstrong from the previous podcast episode. Walter Daugherty was a shift supervisor at HMSE. I believe is still at HMSE. Cole Mathis is still a paramedic at HMSE. His partner Joey Smith moved on, I believe, to an unrelated field. I'm not sure where he's working these days, but I don't think it's in EMS. Chris Potter was a shift supervisor at HMSE at the time. Last I heard, he was working on the medical staff at a correctional facility. Sean Sullivan was a paramedic at HMSE, I believe is now a supervisor at HMSE. His partner, Chris Nunley, also now a supervisor at HMSE. Kendall Birdwell was a paramedic at HMSE who, on the day of the storm, I believe was actually working with the rescue squad. He went on to become a flight paramedic. His dad, Britt Birdwell, also a paramedic at HMSE and now currently a supervisor at HMSE. Don Webster was HMSE's director of operations at the time. He's now kind of sort of retired, but not really. He's their public information officer. You see him on TV still quite frequently. Dale Strong makes an appearance. He has been a first responder in this area for many, many years and now is our representative in the United States Congress. Jeff Gray was a reporter here at WHNT Channel 19 for a long, long time. He was also an intermediate EMT and was known for putting the camera down and helping out in situations where that was required. We always really respected him and appreciated him for that. He's out of broadcasting and EMS completely at this point. He lives in Las Vegas where he works in a casino doing security. At one point, Rob was speaking about the president of Alabama A&M at the time of the storm. It sounds like he calls him Mr. Houdini, which I thought was some kind of joke, but his name actually is Andrew Hugini, H-U-G-I-N-E, Jr. Not sure if that's the right way to pronounce it or not, but I don't think Rob was making a joke there. I'll put a link to the news story that Rob mentioned about meteorologist Gary Dobbs, whose home was hit by the tornado while he was broadcasting on that day. And if you're watching the video version of the podcast, I'm just going to run some pictures from the area from that day. A lot of these actually were taken by Tina and Terry. They mentioned those in their episode. The rest of them I have just lifted from various sources. None of these belong to me. I think that's all the housekeeping stuff. So please enjoy my interview with Rob Gaffin.
So on the 27th, on the day the storm happened, what were you doing? Where were you working and who were you with?
I was working Station 5 on Port Room at King Solver. It's a day just like today.
What area did you mostly work in?
We had two different areas we worked.
Okay.
But initially, when the first wave, we're not sure if it was just straight line winds or tornado or what, but our first day with the storm, we had a shortness of breath call over on Cagle Drive off Winchester. While we were there, we saw it was getting really bad and the wind started picking up really heavily. So we wrapped that up at that house as fast as we could. And on the way with the patient to the hospital, the wind and the rain were so hard. I mean, it hurt.
Mm-hmm.
So we drove and we knew on the way up Winchester Road towards Moore's Mill, we were fixing to drive through a tornado that we had no doubt in our mind. And we knew the truck was fixing to flip over at any time.
Really?
It was scary. Matt was literally holding the wheel with both hands on one side, trying to keep the truck straight.
Holy crap.
So we get up to Moore's Mill in Winchester, and the traffic light's literally spinning. And Matt didn't want to drive under it because he knew it was fixing to come down on him.
Wow.
But we didn't have a choice. So we drove through that. By the time we got to the hospital, it was done and over with.
Mm-hmm.
So we were just kind of like, phew, and that was scary. So we went back to Station 5, and it wasn't very long after that we got a call over on Moore's Mill Road. On the way down Moore's Mill Road, it literally looked like, once you pass Kroger, head up Moore's Mill, it looked like Paul Bunyan ran through and just knocked everything down.
Wow.
And we were like, man, that's what we drove through. But we were down there. A tree fell on a gentleman's house, and he was standing on top of his house trying to cut the tree, and he fell off. So that was our call after that. That was our first storm victim, if you will. So we take him to the hospital, head back to Station 5, and the weather had gotten so bad, we knew there's no sense in us going back to Station 5.
Mm-hmm.
So we sat at the Wabaho parking lot at the corner of the intersection because we knew there was no point in trying to even go in and sit down.
Right.
So we sat there in the parking lot and got a call way out in Tony for an electrocution. Headed out that way. Grimwood Road was so flooded by that point. Our response time was just crazy. Because we couldn't get up Winchester Road fast at all because it was flooded in multiple spots.
Mm-hmm.
Then we get near Murphy Hill, come up toward Murphy Hill on Grimwood, and the hail storm.
Yeah.
It was hitting the windshield so hard, we were literally ducking. Because we knew the windshield on that ambulance was fixing a bus. There was no doubt in our mind it was fixing a bus.
Mm-hmm.
As we're passing a storm shelter, we're looking at the storm shelter, and there are about four or five cars at the storm shelter on the side of the road. And Matt says, "You think we should have stopped?" I said, "Can we?" So anyway, we made the trek through the hailstorm and the wind to this house, and nobody was home. And by this time, the power was out already. There was nobody home. So we heard them sending units over to Carter's Gin in that area. And those units were already obstructed from the debris.
Mm-hmm.
So we cleared up. We told MedCom that we were cleared and asked them if they want us to head over that way because we were pretty near there anyway. So we were able to access up Carter's Gin from Old Tony Road and Jeff Road up that way. So we turn onto Jennery Road, and everything looks, you know, pretty much intact. There's a lot of debris. We get a quarter mile up Jennery Road, and everything's gone.
Wow.
Gone. So we're looking off to our left. If you're facing south, we look to the left and everything's gone. So we're making contact with people walking down the road. There's several homeowners and residents in the area. Making contact with all of them, made contact with County Fire, and they had pretty much cleared that little general area we were in. So we're hearing Medic 42, which was Tina and Terry, hollering. We didn't know where they were, but they were on the street parallel to us east. Mm-hmm. So we just say, what do we do from here? Well, I guess this area is clear. There's nothing we can do here. Let's head over that way. In the meantime, we find Tina and Terry on Old Eli off of Bullwinkle. That whole neighborhood is destroyed. So they had started triage up around that general area. We have one patient who had been thrown 150 yards out in the field. He had obvious head injury, AMS, femur fractures. We took care of him while triaging other people. There was a 1077 patient in the house around the corner. The water was in the neighborhood, at the end of the neighborhood right there, was already like thigh high. So we're trekking through that water, trying to clear everything. Well, County Fire had several personnel there, and they had already cleared a couple of streets. And they found a couple of patients back off on another street that we couldn't access. So we had to get the head injury guy out of there. So I don't remember which medic unit, but it was Cole and Joey. We put that guy in the back of a pickup truck and drove him to the end of the street to meet them, because we were all blocked in by this point. Mm-hmm. And they took him. Then we had an elderly couple that we had to evacuate and get to the hospital. So we put them on the back of the same pickup and drove them out to another unit, got them out of there. So in the meantime, County Fire comes up. No, it wasn't. It was Rick Brown with the Sheriff's Department. He comes up and tells me there's another storm coming. It's 10 minutes out. So by this time, it already started drizzling. The wind was picking up, and we're just like, oh, boy. Our trucks are blocked in. We had to move fire trucks and whatnot. So we get back out to the edge of the neighborhood and go a little deeper in. Managed to find two women that were in one of the few houses standing. And they lived in the house next door, which was completely level. There was nothing but a foundation left of these people's homes. And somehow they managed to survive and get to a neighbor's house. So we had to make a bridge out of vinyl fencing to cross the floodwater. There was a deep ditch between where we were and them, and they were probably 100 yards from the road. So we pulled the stretchers out there, and we managed to get them packaged. And she had severe wound to her hand, right hand, head injury. I can't remember exactly what the other lady in the house, what her injuries were. But I know the lady I dealt with, head injuries, back pain, severely deformed right hand, abrasions all over. Looking at her house, I don't know how in the world she survived.
What did the house look like?
No, it was nothing. It was a foundation. That was it. And the SUV sitting there that was in a garage, I do believe. It was just sitting there. I have no idea how they survived. None whatsoever. So we managed to get them out. And by this time, it's pouring rain again. But the winds aren't that bad. So we get them out, and Walter had showed up, and the search effort was pretty much suspended because there was no access to the rest of the neighborhood at all. They had to make access and whatnot. So at this point, Matt and I are off work. It's after 6 o'clock, and Walter's like, okay, y'all head back to Station 2, but go Jeff 53 and catch up with Potter and see where he needs you. Well, we left Old Eli, Bullweevil, that neighborhood, and head back out to Jeff 53. And we're looking, and like Piggly Wiggly is destroyed. Everything's gone. Power lines are all down. So we're at Jeff and 53, and we can't raise Potter. And Medcom tells us to head to Lockhart and Oral Smith. Well, we tried. Jeff Road blocked. How do we get there? We had somehow or another, now Matt's familiar with that area because he lives out there. He made his way around. We went up around Forge Chapel. And we're coming up Forge Chapel. Of course, it's flooded everywhere. We're doing the best we can. We see another unit go by us in an opposite direction. How Matt made it to Lockhart and Orville Smith, I have no idea. We caught the power lines on the linebackers once.
Oh.
It was literally like a maze. In, out, off the road. I don't know how we didn't get stuck nonetheless, make it there. Because we literally had to go off the road. But the power lines were so low at some points, we just knew there was no way through it. finally, we're behind Medic 91, and I don't know how they ended up with two injured people on a bus on Wall Triana. I have no idea.
Like a bus? Like a
like a school bus.
Oh, okay.
At 7 o'clock, 7:30 at night. I don't know how they did that. Anyway, Medic 91 was in front of us. And I say Wall Triana, it was Oral Bed. We made it out to Oral Bed in Harvest. Medic 91 stops their truck in the middle of the road in front of us. And we're like, we got to go. So Dale Strong, we told him, move their truck so we can go. So he moves their truck out of the way so we can go through the maze. We turned on Orville Smith right there off of Oral Bed and Lockhart wise off right there at that intersection. The water was really deep. So, but we trekked through it anyway. I said, you think it's too deep? I said, I can see the stop sign. So we go up Orville Smith, literally just shy of a quarter of a mile, and it's blocked. The reason we're going there is because X-Ray 5 was there calling for help. They had multiple patients. We stopped right there by Medic 5's truck, big tree down right there. There's no way to get up Orville Smith, period. And we grab our stretcher, our monitor, and our bag and head back there to help them. Now, it's a half a mile from where we are to where they are. Every power line and tree along the way is down across the road, across the ditches. We took our stretcher every bit. It's probably just shy of a half a mile over all the trees. And the power lines are like waist high, thigh high, and they're still stretched tight, laying perpendicular with the road or parallel with the road, in the road and off to the side. And all we can do is hope like hell they're dead. So one of us had to sacrifice ourselves. So we just grabbed the power lines and lifted them up where we could. But we had to literally drop the stretcher and force it up under a tree to get past it at one point. It was horrible. Then we had to trek through more water that was knee high back and zigzag across the ditches to get back there to them. We finally made it back there to them. It took us probably a half hour to get the stretcher back there with our equipment. Medic 5 is there, and they have one patient who's unresponsive lying in the back of a pickup truck.
Sorry, X-ray 5.
Right.
Okay.
And they have C-spined him to a piece of plywood, which I have to applaud him for that. That was pretty good. Now, he's unresponsive. Obvious major head injuries. His head is bruised all over. So first thing I notice, he's got a pulse rate of 30. And I quickly assess what other patients they had there in that immediate area. They were in the street, in the back of a pickup truck. And they had there one patient in the back of the pickup truck with this unresponsive patient. And they said that they had two more in a house across the way from where we were at. And then there was one 1077 patient lying in the field just across the way from where we were at also. So I make a quick decision. Okay, let's do what we can for this guy. So we put him on the monitor and get started with him. He's got a pulse rate of 30. He's unresponsive. So I get an EJ on him and I push a milligram of atropine and we get his heart rate up to about 130. And we're doing good. There's a lady standing there. I had no idea who she was, but it turned out she was a nursing student who graduates this month. So she was in the thick of it. We had her bagging him while doing the atropine. So then we get him intubated, and no sooner than we get him intubated, he loses his heart rate and he goes straight into V-fib. So we have all these patients. We have him who's coded. We got to make a decision. What are we going to do? Because we cannot get him out. Well, improvise and overcome. Okay. We didn't have access to these other patients. This other patient in the back of the truck with him's fairly stable. Didn't want to call him stable at all, but he's fairly stable. Okay. We can do this. Somehow, we managed to raise MedCom. X-ray 5's A units didn't work out there. And mine worked in this one little spot I could stand, and they could barely hear me. We were able to get them to send us a unit to sit on the other side for when we pulled him out. So we shocked him. He went straight into asystole, did the epiatrophine, had bystander helping us do CPR, and lo and behold, he got a pulse back around 80 or so. And he started breathing on his own about 4 times a minute. Now we got this nursing student bagging. We've got 4 other guys back there with us. I'm assuming they were all residents of that area. We make the decision to get this guy out. So we took off through the water, over the trees, over the power lines, with the stretcher of this man on it. Medic 32 arrived before we got back there. Thank goodness. So we take him and we give him to Medic 32. At this time, he was still resuscitated pretty good. I mean, he started breathing pretty good. His heart rate was good. You can just tell he had massive internal head injury. So Medic 32 gives me their equipment, and they take ours, and they take off to the hospital with the patient. Then we have to make the decision whether or not to go back or wait until we can get this cleared so we can drive through. So we made the decision to go back. By this time, Medic 32 is gone, and I forget what medic unit Sean Sullivan and Chris Nunney were that day, but they were there. They parked behind us. They made it back there to us. So we had them for help, which gave us some extra equipment. So we make it back there with 32's equipment that they gave us. Chris and Sean had brought 2 more patients back there. Had got them from a house back across the way and whatnot. They had assessed the 1077 patient. Well, the 1077 patient was a 15-year-old female. And then we had these 3 patients, and no way we could make that trek again and get all these people out again. You know, we had 2 stretchers, 3 patients, and it was a really long walk. I stood in my one little spot and called MedCom on my phone, and I had to call like 3 or 4 times. There was just no signal there. So we're trying to do everything we can. I finally got a good enough signal to get MedCom, and I asked them where any of the rescue squad vehicles were, and if they could get me one out here and clear us a path out of here. Now this, you probably won't hear me say this too often. This is where Kendall gets the attaboy. MedCom raised Rescue 2, which was Kendall and another gentleman, I don't know his name. They made it to our scene in probably 10 minutes from the phone call, 10, 15 minutes, and cleared a path big enough to drive that truck through, the pickup truck, in about 20 minutes through nearly a half a mile of debris and telephone poles. They managed to clear it. And by this time, the one patient that was already there initially, he was 40-some-odd years old. You know, his abdomen was already swollen and rigid. Come find out later, he had a liver or a spleen laceration, something, and some fractured ribs. I don't really remember what all. But by that time, he was pretty bad.
This was the one you said earlier you didn't want to call stable, but it was relatively stable. Right, I got it. Right.
So, like I say, by that time, he's rigid and he's really hurting. Starting to have trouble breathing. Had that pickup with him in the back. We literally put the stretchers up in the beds of the pickups. And there was another pickup that they managed to get the other 2 there in. So we had 2 pickups in line. The pickup in the back had like a 16-year-old female and her mom. They had head injuries and whatnot. I don't remember exactly what was wrong with them because Chris and Sean were taking care of them primarily. But before Kendall and Rescue 2 got there and cleared us a path, we had to make a decision on who to get out of there and when, because we didn't know if we were going to get a path cleared. We didn't know if we were going to get out of there. Mm-hmm. Like 3 hours is what our scene time was in that one scene. So I made the corporate decision that the guy with the rigid abdomen and shortness of breath and whatnot was going first. We needed to see what we could do about getting him out of there, because the 4 guys that were there that helped us get the full arrest out or the post arrest out, they never came back. Never came back.
They weren't patients. They were just bystanders that were helping you.
Right. They didn't come back in with us. We turned around at one point, and Jeff Gray on Channel 19 is there. And Jeff was a tremendous help. He did everything we asked him to, and he was pretty on the ball and on task. So once we found out Rescue 2 was coming and whatnot, then that decision became a lot easier. Mm-hmm. We'll just wait. So we get back to the trucks. After they cleared us a path, we drove both pickups out to our ambulances. We're carrying, X-ray 5 carried one patient because Don had come on the radio and said the priority twos go to Crestwood. Well, we had two patients that we were deeming priority one. So X-ray 5 took the priority two patient to Crestwood. We take the man with the abdomen to Huntsville, and Chris and Sean carry the head injury patient to Huntsville. We finally get out, and the roads are just nearly impassable on the way back to the hospital. So we come up on Blake Bottom down near the bridge, and the water's deep. We can tell it's pretty deep, but we don't really have a choice at this point. We got to go somewhere. We got off in that water, and it kept getting deeper and deeper into it. The headlights were literally in the water. Somehow, Matt managed to drive it to it. He said he was scared to death. So we made it through the water. We were finally able to get him to Huntsville Hospital. And don't ask me how, we left after Sean and Chris did, and we beat them pretty good. I don't know which way they went. But anyhow, after that, our truck was pretty much trashed. We had no supplies. We didn't have anything. Everything was gone. Our C-spine equipment, you know, the only reason I had any drugs was because 32 left me their bag. Everything. It was just a complete mess. And by this point, you know, it's like almost 11 o'clock at night, and we're at the hospital. We have to go back at work at 5:45 in the morning. Soaking wet. Our feet were soaking wet for like 8 hours, and it was starting to get just that feeling. Your feet are just mush. And we had been soaking wet for a long time. So we were kind of cold and worn slack out at this point. So we finally were able to make it back to Station 2 and go home. By the time I even got home, got a shower, and got in bed, it was 1:30 in the morning, and had to come back at 5:45 the next morning. Matt had stepped on a nail. We were doing kind of a quick search out there off Orville Smith Road. We were walking back because Jeff Gray and Matt both heard somebody yelling at one point, way off in the distance. So we were kind of walking back to find who it was that was yelling, and Matt stepped on a nail at that point. And all I could think that next day, you ever wish you could do something different? You could go back and done something different. We had to leave that 15-year-old female there. Once we left, there was only one person left out there who knew where she was, and he was a county fire department responder. And we had to have him hang out to show the sheriff's department where she was at. If I could have done anything different, I wouldn't have left her laying out there in that field like that. Would have scooped her up, brought her out to the roadside with something. Because I hated, given the situation, having to leave her laying out there in the field. I just hated that. Other than that, we came back to work the next day. Matt did not return to work the next day because he was beat up and hurting. So came back and I worked with Brett the next day. And I think we ran 14 calls. It was a crazy day. And the bad thing about the day after was going on that little sleep and going back to work. The last thing you thought was, you're not going to be able to eat that day because there's nothing open. There's no food anywhere. So Britt and I come back to work, and it's 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and we're thinking, we're hungry. We haven't eaten all day long. We finally were driving back to Station 5 at one point, and we saw smoke coming from the grill by the cafeteria over at Alabama A&M. And we said, oh, we've got to. So we pull in there by the Elmore building, and there's a line of people at that grill where they're feeding them. And we're like, man, we'll never get to eat. We'll never sit here long enough to eat. So we're starting to leave, and some of the administration flagged us down and told us to come over there, and they gave us a box full of food. And the president, Mr. Houdini, the president of A&M, he was standing out there. Super nice guy. But they gave us an entire box of food that lasted us through the day, and we actually even fed some other people with it. We were so thankful for that because that was all we had and all we could get. Driving around, we had to go, like, Beaver Dam was closed because there was a huge tree. I'd be hard-pressed to find a tree that big anymore. Had fallen across the road. And we got a call where we had to go out to Tony, but right there at Beaver Dam on Flask Pike, it was closed. That's where we went. So we had to detour at Beaver Dam to Bo Howard. There were some citizens there with chainsaw who had literally cut a tunnel in that tree where it had fallen over, and they just cut out everything they could over the road on one lane.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how we got through it. I don't have any idea how Brett drove the truck through there. Man, we were creeping through it. And that thing was huge, but it was literally like a tree tunnel. But I tell you what, we went to a double funeral. Derek Horst and I, a paramedic in Hackleburg that was killed in a storm.
Right, I was there.
Oh, that's right. The Wrangler Distribution Center, gone. It was all over the highway.
Mm-hmm.
It's absolutely demolished. I think that's where Gary Dodd lived. You know, he got sucked out of his house.
Really?
Yeah. There's audio. He was on the phone live with Channel 31. He's like, I got to go. You hear the phone drop. He was running through his house trying to get out to his storm shelter. In the front of the house started flying apart before he could reach the back of the house. And it threw him.
Oh,
yeah, he was in the hospital for a while.
Wow.
So it was just a big mess. It was a big, big mess. But we made it out finally about midnight. And I can't believe our truck made it through that night. But yeah, we managed to get those people out. And they had the propane tanks for these mobile homes and whatnot out there on Orville Smith. They had all busted loose and no one had shut them off. So the gas out there blowing around was just pretty intense. And it's like they would never run out. You would think in 3 hours a wide open gas tank would run out. At some point, no, they keep blowing. It was just crazy to walk up through there and see nothingness where a house once stood. Between the 4, 5, 6 of us that were back there with these patients, one of us had a flashlight.
Really?
It's pretty dark out there when there's no power anywhere in the county and you only got one flashlight.
Was that you that had the flashlight?
No, it was Matt, and he had a little one. A little bitty stinger. You know, we were trying to use the flashlights on our droids as much as we could, but we couldn't. Man, we were stuck back there. You run your battery down using that flashlight, what are you going to do? That was the only means of contact we had because our units weren't working. So I finally had to quit using my flashlight on my droid just to save battery so I had some means of communication. I just remember, man, taking that post-arrest back out to Medic 32. And those four guys who were with us helping us, you know, we had to go around trees, through the ditch, around the butt of the tree, back through the ditch, up onto the road kind of stuff. Constantly.
Yeah.
And those four guys lifted one tree. They lifted one probably 2 feet, just enough for us to slide under with him. They never did come back in.
Mm-hmm.
Never did come back in. When we got out there, I asked a sheriff's deputy who had pulled up. I don't know how he got through there with the water. But he had made it there somehow. And I said, man, is there any way you can help us track down somebody with a chainsaw? Just a chainsaw is all we need. And he said, man, you know how it is. He said, you'd be hard pressed. That's when I was just like, I'll find a way. I was going through the thought process. All right. I'm sure the rescue squad has been burning their chainsaws up. If they even crank at this point, I'll be lucky. But they did. Thank goodness they got, because I don't know what we'd have done had they not done that. Yeah, we would have had to take all those people out one by one on foot. We'd have been there till 3 o'clock in the morning, and who knows if they would have even survived had we not got them out when we did.
Right. I heard you on the radio a lot that day. It sounded like you did a great job.
Okay.
Has this affected you personally? Like, how would you say that it's affected you?
Personally, the biggest emotional factor is the fact that I wasn't able to do anything but grow on the field. I can't stand it. I think about that all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And if I could have just sunk in anything, but, you know, you do what you got to do, do your job, and you move on. You just hate it for all those people. You hate it for all those people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they're sitting there watching TV, probably having a birthday party or something, having the time of their life, and all of a sudden, devastated. Their lives flip upside down. You just hate it for those people.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll say I was one of the fortunate ones. I didn't get any damage. I had paperwork in my yard from Coleman.
Wow.
The Coleman Christian Academy school sign landed up by our house.
Wow. You live in New Hope, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, the first thing we noticed were all the shingles laying everywhere. I'm like, man, I got to get up and patch that roof. So I got my ladder there, went up on the roof, and I'm up there looking, and there's no shingles missing. Where'd all this come from? And there's insulation all over the yard, like the chunks of yellow insulation all over the yard. I'm like, well, that's not good if it blew my house apart in some spot where it even sucked the insulation out. I got to find it.
Mm-hmm.
Never found it. I went up in the attic. My insulation was white. And I was like, that can't be mine. It's not mine. So the debris actually flew that far.
Mm-hmm.
One piece of paperwork we found in our yard was an insurance claim from the Church of the God in Hansville, where they had been damaged, called their insurance agent. She did up the claim report, and then her office got blown away.
Wow.
So it was a claim report from April the 27th from that church that the insurance agent had done
mm-hmm.
in our yard. Then you know they hadn't had a chance to mail it. There's no way it got lost in the mail and ended up in New York. So it blew that
mm-hmm.
along that sign. It's crazy.
It's amazing.
Absolutely crazy.
Have you ever worked anything like this in your career before?
Not an MCI like that. Never anything to that scale, ever.
Mm-hmm.
Probably won't ever again.
Right.
But nothing's comparable to that.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing. I've never sat there and patients, non-ambulatory patients just keep showing up. Rescue 2, before they could even start cutting to get to us, they had ambulatory patients walking up to them trying to get help.
Mm-hmm.
And they literally had to tell them, you're going to have to wait. You'll have to go over here and sit down. We'll deal with you when we can. I was thankful for the lights when we got back to the ambulance.
Mm-hmm.
Man, it's dark out there, especially trying to get through all that stuff in the dark. There's not any source of light at all.
Right.
But we managed to resuscitate one and found out he was herniated.
Oh, wow.
So he died in the ER. But yeah, there was a neighbor or friend of his while we were resuscitating. He'd come up and say, is that I don't have a clue. And then somebody else said, yeah, that fella just broke down right there behind us. So not only are you dealing with medical patients, you got to deal with these emotionally distraught people. It just froze the curveball.
Has this like changed your perspective on EMS in general at all? Like, I feel like you're sort of at the end of your career and ready to get out. And I mean, has it changed the way you think about it?
It reminded me why I do this. It reminded me of why I chose this profession. And those times more recently are getting further and further in between.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it reminded me why I'm here.
I would love to share your critical incident on the podcast. If you have a story you want to tell, send it to me by email at thekppod@gmail.com. That's thekppod@gmail.com. You can send it in writing and I'll read the story. You can make a high quality recording of yourself telling the story and I'll play that. Or I can interview you about it, either remotely or in person. Thank you for listening. And as always, stay safe, take care of yourself, and take care of your patients in that order.